Welcome to number 5.
Verse 46. Then Nebuchadnezzar fell on his face. The greatest king in the world falls on his face. Not to worship Daniel necessarily, but because he himself is so overcome by this dream. In homage to Daniel, this man in whom dwells the spirit of the gods, who could interpret this dream, and gave orders to present him an offering and fragrant incense. And surely your God is a God of gods and Lord of kings, a revealer of mysteries. And the king promoted Daniel and gave him many great gifts and made him ruler over the whole province of Babylon and chief prefect over all the wise men of Babylon. And then Daniel made a request. He didn't forget his friends, did he? And he appointed Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego over the administration of the province of Babylon while Daniel was at the king's court. Now, I want you to see, everything is peaceful. The Gentile world ruler, the mightiest man in the world, has made peace, hasn't he, with these representatives of the Judean exiles. Okay? Turn back to the book of Habakkuk toward the front of your, toward the back of your Bible. It's about the 5th book from the end of the Old Testament. Jonah, Micah, Nahum, Habakkuk, Zephaniah, Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi. So it's about the 5th small book from the end of the Old Testament. Habakkuk wrote this book and preached between probably 609 and 605 B.C. Now, who's alive in Jerusalem between 609 and 605 B.C.? Obviously, Daniel, Mishael, Hananiah, Azariah, they're all there, aren't they? Because Nebuchadnezzar invaded in 605. And these young men now, the ones that just are involved in this historical narrative, are in Jerusalem, and without a doubt, they're listening to Habakkuk preach. And they know what Habakkuk is talking about. For those of you who haven't read Habakkuk, when you meet Habakkuk in heaven, he'll say, "How'd you like my book?" What book was that? So just so you won't have to say, "What book was that?" maybe you should read Habakkuk sometime between now and when the Lord comes. Habakkuk had a lot to say. The first thing he said was, verse 6, "I'm raising up the Chaldeans." Whoa! Hold on. Raising up the Chaldeans, the Babylonians, Habakkuk said, they're worse than we are. How can you send somebody worse than we are in to get us? That caused a little problem in Habakkuk's mind. But that brought about chapter 2, verse 2, "The Lord answered me and said," verse 4, "the righteous will live by his faith." Does that sound familiar? The righteous will live by his faith. That's the verse that started the Reformation. That's the verse that changed Martin Luther's mind. Because Paul picks that up in Romans chapter 1, verse 17. But that verse comes from Habakkuk. And the historical setting of that verse was, even when something's going on that you don't understand, and even when something's going on that seems illogical to you, the righteous man will live by his faith. Now, that's a key to life. God, you can't send people more wicked than we are in to judge us. Don't worry what I'm doing, Habakkuk. You have faith in what I'm doing. You see, God doesn't do things because we think they're right. If God does things, they are right. We have it mixed up. Well, it must be right because God doesn't. No, if God does it, it is right. The righteous man will live by his faith. And that's the context here. And I think that lesson on faith impacted on the lives of Hananiah, Azariah, and Mishael. Because there were certainly some strange things going on when they saw good King Josiah killed in 609. And they saw Nebuchadnezzar come in 605 and take them captive to Babylon. And they were good Jewish young men. Wow. The righteous man will live by his faith, even when it doesn't seem logical. And then he heard Habakkuk say, or they heard Habakkuk say, on over in 2:18 and 19, what profit is the idol when the maker has carved it, or an image, a teacher of falsehood, for its maker trusts in its handiwork, when he fashions speechless idols. Woe to him who says to a piece of wood, awake, to a dumb stone, arise, and that is your teacher? Behold, it is overlaid with gold and silver, and there is no breath inside of it at all. So these three young men learned at least two important lessons. Have faith when things are illogical. Trust God. And number two, you better not believe in idols. And those two principles, among many others, when they were between 12 and 14 years of age, stuck with them. Because we're going to see it again very soon in chapter 3. Now go to Daniel chapter 3. Now what I want you to forget about, I want you to forget the Sunday school approach to Daniel chapter 3. Okay, Daniel chapter 3, with all good intentions, has been misaligned and misrepresented as a Sunday school story. Because all anyone ever thinks about are the three little boys that get thrown in a fiery furnace and get rescued in the fourth minute. But there's much more to it than that. Okay, this chapter is here for a very specific purpose, not just to give us a nice Sunday school story, which is a good, don't misunderstand me, I'm not saying it's not a good Sunday school story. It's a great Sunday school story for children, to show how God delivers and to show how it's worth standing for God. But we want to look at it a little differently than that this morning. Daniel chapter 3, as a total chapter, gives us a prophetic, it has three purposes to it. One, it gives the historic account of what actually happened during the reign of Nebuchadnezzar and in the lives of these three young men. Historic account. Number two, it has application for us today. Romans 15:4. Those things which happened in the Old Testament were given to us for examples, that through them we may be encouraged. So everything in the Old Testament has an example for us, so we can apply it today. And number three, this chapter gives us a prophetic picture of the tribulation. And as we begin to see the things in here, you'll see it really does show us many things that are going to happen during the tribulation. Now remember that prior to the smiting stone coming, as we saw back in Daniel chapter 2, verse 44, just prior to the smiting stone is that 7-year tribulation period. Now turn your Bibles to the book of Matthew chapter 24. And let's see what Jesus said about that in verses 29 and 30. Matthew 24. This again is a response to a question by the disciples. And Jesus is summing up and he's told some other information here, but we'll just look at these two verses. Matthew 24, 29. But immediately after the tribulation of those days, so here's the 7-year tribulation just about over with. The sun will be darkened, and the moon will not give its light, and the stars will fall from the sky, and the powers of the heavens will be shaken. And then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in the sky, and all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man, the stone, cut without hands, coming on the clouds of the sky with power and great glory. So there's the second coming. Just after the tribulation, the smiting stone. Okay, now, to back up and see what's going on during this tribulation time, and again, we could spend weeks looking at that, I suppose. I want you to go back. We're going to look at two places, Daniel, and then we're going to look at Revelation. So we're going to anticipate something we'll see several weeks from now in Daniel chapter 9, but it gives us a little clue that ties in with what happens between Daniel 2 and Daniel 3, because during the tribulation period, there's going to be an initial time of peace, about 3.5 years. At the midpoint of the tribulation, that peace treaty will be broken with the Jews, and great persecution of the Jews will begin. Daniel chapter 9, verse 27. And he, Antichrist, will make a firm covenant with the many for 1 week. That's a 7-year period. And in the middle of the week, he will put a stop to sacrifice and grain offering. And on the wing of abominations will come one who makes desolate, even until a complete destruction. So in the midpoint of the tribulation period, this peace treaty is broken. Go back to the book of Revelation. Let's go to chapter 13. Now, these verses I'm giving you here in Daniel and in Revelation just show you how Daniel chapter 3 is going to give us a prophetic picture of what's going to happen in the tribulation. Because as we study chapter 3 in Daniel, you'll say, oh, that sounds familiar. At least it's typical or prophetic of something that's going to be happening. Daniel chapter 13, verse 14. And he deceives those who dwell on the earth because of the signs which it was given him to perform in the presence of the beast, telling those who dwell on the earth to make an image to the beast who had the wound of the sword and has come to life. And it was given to him to give breath to the image of the beast, that the image of the beast might even speak and cause as many as do not worship the image of the beast to be killed. Back up to verse 13. So, Antichrist in the tribulation is going to set up an image. Verse 13. And he performs great signs, so that he even makes fire come down out of heaven to the earth in the presence of men. The false prophet, the beast, and the beast will use fire as a means of fear to cause worship of the beast's image. Now I'll go over to verse 18, same chapter. Here is wisdom. Let him who has understanding calculate the number of the beast, for the number is that of a man, and his number is 666. So the system of the beast has a numerical equivalent attached to it. Now let's go back to Daniel chapter 3. Nebuchadnezzar the king made an image of gold, the height of which was 60 cubits and its width 6 cubits. He set it up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. We have a quick transition here from chapter 2 to chapter 3. Immediately after this image dream that he had, Nebuchadnezzar begins to work on his own image and sets it up in the plain of Dura. Now, there are probably several reasons for this image. Number one, I think his dream had something to do with it. It motivated him to make a real image. He was so impressed by the awesomeness of this image. And it's possible that the words of Daniel saying, after you shall come, Nebuchadnezzar didn't like that so much. He didn't want anybody to come after him. You know, everyone has this feeling of eternity, you know. So what he did, rather than just being content with his head being the head of gold, he wanted a whole image of gold. So he sets up this gold image, maybe representing himself. That's one reason. He removed all these other metals, the silver, bronze, iron, and made it all gold. So in a way, it'd be symbolic that no one could come after him. His kingdom was going to be forever. Babylon, forever. Two, I think probably this was as much a political move as a religious move. Remember, Nebuchadnezzar has conquered a lot of other nations, and he's brought in, just as he did with the Judeans, representatives of all other nations, and he has begun to train them to send back as ambassadors and diplomats to all the other nations. And this was not an unusual thing to do. This was the reason behind the Caesar cult. Later on, when Rome ruled, Caesar worship was a political move, more than a religious move. Caesar worship and calling Caesar God was a way to weld the kingdom together, was a way to weld all these nations together in a common religion. Antichrist will do that in the future, to dwell together different people, different nations in a common religion. Religion is a great unifier. And Nebuchadnezzar knew that. So it's not just as simple as saying worship this or worship that. This is a political, religious move. That's why he gathers only the elite. Common people aren't there. The dignitaries are there. The ambassadors are there. His leaders are the satraps, the commissioners, the counselors, the leaders of his kingdom are there. He has this thing all orchestrated, believe me, to make sure everyone molds and blends and welds together in one unified system. Because remember, the reason that the head of the image is Nebuchadnezzar is that there's a unity, and there was a unity about the Babylonian kingdom. Fine gold. This is one of the reasons behind it. Now I want you to see the similarities in this prophetic picture. Here we are, the Gentile world ruler, whose equivalent in the future will be Antichrist. He has, in the previous verse, made peace with the Jews. Very quickly now, under a false pretense, that peace is going to be broken. Do you see the dimensions of his statue? What are they? 60 by 6. Even the same number system is used with his image and with the number system associated with the beast. Everyone is gathered together around Nebuchadnezzar's beast, Jew and Gentile, and that's what's going to happen in the future as well. Now let's go on down. I want you to see something here. This meeting, this great group of people, have come together not to worship. They've come to an official political meeting. This is a meeting for dedication of this great image. Then Nebuchadnezzar the king sent word. Now, by the way, he didn't have to say RSVP. Keep that in mind. Nebuchadnezzar sent word to assemble the satraps, the prefects, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the judges, the magistrates, all the rulers of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. Then the satraps, the prefects, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the judges, the magistrates, and all the rulers of the province were assembled for the dedication of the image that Nebuchadnezzar the king set up. And they stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. There is still an area called Tola Dura. It's a historical, it's a real geographical place. It's 12 miles south of a city called Hillah, and there's a river that runs into the Euphrates about 6 miles south of the old city of Babylon. When an archaeologist named Olpert was there and excavated during the last century, he discovered in that area called Tola Dura a large platform, stone platform, 45 feet square by 20 feet high. Tola Dura means in Aramaic a walled area, which could mean the mountains around there, or there could have been a wall there. So it's this large area, and there has been found a platform that Olpert believes was the platform for this image. Well, it's impressive nonetheless. All these people are gathered around, all the ranks of people, all the dignitaries. You can imagine this blazing desert sun bouncing off this 90 foot high gold overlaid image with a ratio of 1 to 10. 90 feet by 9 feet. And the sun's bouncing off of it. And there's an orchestra playing music. All kinds of instruments. The orchestra's playing, and it's been set up ahead of time, and we'll hear the herald speak in a minute. And he's going to tell what the purpose of this orchestra is. Now, here's a herald. You can imagine the trumpets blow, da-da-da-da, and this herald. Remember, everyone's in costume. Beautiful, they've worn their finest. Everyone's in his oriental finery, representing his office. There are turbans and crowns and silks in colors, and they're all standing there for what they believe is going to be a dedication ceremony. Then the herald speaks. And here's what he says, verse 4. Then the herald loudly proclaimed, To you the command is given, O peoples, nations, and men of every language. So, obviously, here these emissaries working for Nebuchadnezzar all out through here. That at the moment you hear the sound of the horn, flute, lyre, trigon, psaltery, bagpipe, and all kinds of music, you are to fall down and worship the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar the king has set up. Whoa. I think a little ripple went through the audience. Can you see one saying to the other, hey, I came here for a dedication. You know, I didn't come here to worship this image. I have other gods that I serve. So there's a little ripple, and I'm sure Nebuchadnezzar saw this little ripple go through the standing audience. So just to overcome the little ripple and to take care of any doubts or any hesitancy that might be in the minds of anyone there, he goes on with verse 6. But whoever does not fall down and worship shall immediately be cast into the midst of a furnace of blazing fire. Well, that's what I said. I came here to worship, obviously. The one says to the other. And the one fellow says, well, I thought that big furnace was just to clean up all the cups and plates and everything after the party was over. And this furnace is blazing. So the criteria have been set up for this dedication ceremony. And Nebuchadnezzar is serious, very serious about his program. He spared no expense to put together a ceremony that he believes will weld his kingdom together, that will increase the unity of his kingdom. He's invited the dignitaries there under the pretense of dedication. And once they're there, they are given the command to worship. And as they worship, they represent each nation and country from which they have come as ambassadors and dignitaries to the court of the great Nebuchadnezzar. And suddenly, with the furnace over here blazing, everyone there is on the spot. What do I do? Well, Nebuchadnezzar is serious about his dedication slash worship program. Verse 7, therefore, now remember, one of the simple rules of biblical interpretation is, anytime you see the word therefore, what do you say to yourself? What's the therefore? Therefore. Well, the therefore is therefore because at the time you hear all the music and so on, therefore, if you don't want to get the blazing fire in the furnace, this is what you do. Therefore, at the time when all the peoples heard the sound of the music, the horn, the flute, lyre, trigon, psaltery, bagpipe, all the peoples and nations and language. You see, men of every is in italics. You're not in the original. Nations and language fell down and worshiped the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. So the orchestra begins to play. I mean, this is a lavish ceremony. There's an orchestra up front. All the costumes are out there. And apparently the orchestra begins to play on cue. And it'll play some music and then apparently stop. They'll play some music again and stop. And play some music again and stop. And the key is, every time the music begins to play, everyone bows down. They get back up. And then the music plays again. Everyone bows down. Gets back up. So it's a religious worship service that's keying off of this music that's playing. Imagine what it must have looked like. If we had been up front and the orchestra began to play, and the sun is bouncing off the image, and the bagpipe and flute and trigon begin to play, and all we would see is a sea of backs bowing down to this big golden image, coming back up, bowing down to this golden image, and coming back up from every nation. Turn to the book of Revelation, chapter 13. Again, remember, this is prophetic, really it's symbolic, and it's giving us an idea of what's going to take place. Revelation 13, verse 8, because in the context of Daniel 3, Nebuchadnezzar becomes kind of a type of Antichrist. Of course, we have the Jews here, we have the Gentiles here, we have the blazing furnace here, a type of not only what we saw at the Holocaust, but also what's going to take place in the tribulation. And all who dwell on the earth will worship him. Who do we have in chapter 3? Representatives of every nation. bowing and worshiping the image of the man who is the type of the beast, the Antichrist. And this is what's going to happen in the tribulation, Revelation 13. And all who draw on the earth will worship him, everyone whose name has not been written from the foundation of the world in the book of life of the Lamb who has been slain. Now turn over to verse 15. And there was given to him to give breath to the image of the beast, that the image of the beast might even speak, and cause as many as do not worship the image of the beast to be killed. So you see the prophetic picture, Daniel chapter 3, the actual fulfillment, which is going to take place in the tribulation, Revelation chapter 13. So, now if we could be standing up here, listening to the music play, watching the sea of backs go down, suddenly something would catch our eyes. We'd look over here, and out of this whole sea of humanity, there are three men standing. Now imagine what it would be like to be all alone by yourself, really in the minority. Everyone else is bowing, and you're looking around, and you're standing up, and everyone else is bowing down. A very embarrassing situation. Or is it a situation where they could feel a sense of pride, religious arrogance? I think not. Just the power of God within them, knowing that they simply cannot bow down to this image. But hundreds and thousands prostrate before the image, and these three young men standing up on their feet. Verse 8. For this reason, what reason? At that time, certain Chaldeans came forward and brought charges against the Jews. Anti-Semitism is not a new phenomenon. It begins back here. It was going on before this. But certainly we can see that the Jews are always, in the past, present, and future, because they are God's chosen people, going to be the subjects of satanic attack. And even back here, the Chaldeans are ready just to jump on them and bring charges against them. And I want you to look in your margin, if you have a New American Standard Bible, verse 8. You see what the marginal reference is for the line which says brought charges against? Ate the pieces of. That's what the Aramaic literally means. The Chaldeans came and ate the pieces of the Jews. That's how bitter the attack was that they were making against these three Jewish men to King Nebuchadnezzar. Anti-Semitism. Again, symbolic of what the Holocaust is going to be, and also symbolic in a real sense of what the tribulation is going to be. Look in your Bibles, if you will, to the book of Matthew. Let's go to Matthew chapter 24, verse 9. I'll just show you one verse. Remember, this part of chapter 24 is a result of the request of the disciples to Christ. In verse 3, tell us, when will these things be, and what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age, Matthew 24, 3. And Jesus begins to say some things to them. But the verse I just want to draw your attention to very quickly is verse 9.